It's time for another trip into the golden history of Hollywood and another podcast from the Warner Archive Collection. I'm George Feltenstein, and it's my pleasure to be your host for this very special podcast because we have a very special guest joining us today, Mr. Peter Ford, the son of the legendary, versatile, and beloved actor Glenn Ford. Glenn Ford stars in Day of the Evil Gun, which is coming to the Warner Archive Collection on DVD and digital download for the very first time. Peter has been kind enough to join us today to talk about his dad and his dad's career. And I also want to talk to Peter about his new biography of his father. So Peter Ford, welcome to the Warner Archive Collection podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, George. Glad to be here.
I want to start out asking you about your new book about your dad's life. I read it twice, actually, because I found it so compelling and very, very objective and astute. And it seemed like it was, of course, a labor of love for you. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and how you came to make the decision to write the book and the reception that it has received?
Well, I sure can. The inception of the book came by the virtue of a friend of ours, and MGM certainly, is Miss Anne Francis, who co-starred with Dad in Blackboard Jungle, and she was in another couple of films with him and certainly had a wonderful career as a great gal and a friend of the family. And she was over here one day about 2 years before my dad passed. And he did die in 2006 at age 90, so he lived a long life. And Annie said, "Peter, you've got to write the book," because I've known Ann since they did Blackboard together back in 54. And I said, "Okay, you know, I can write, but gee, it's such an enormous task." And George, I have every one of my father's diaries that he kept since he was 18 years old.
Wow.
And I have every letter he wrote. He made copies. I have every letter he ever received. I have his clipping of his first haircut that my grandmother's kept, every report card, every poem he wrote. And I knew it was going to be an awesome task. And to that end, it took me 7 years to write this book. And my dad and I worked on it a couple of years before he passed, and then 5 years later, this last May, it was finally published, and it's been doing well. It was the best-selling book by the University of Wisconsin Press last year, and it sold over 5,000 copies, and we're hoping it'll keep going, but it was a labor of love, I'll tell you.
And I want you to tell everybody the name of the book.
It's Glenn Ford, A Life, and if folks want to visit my website, I'd love to have them do that. It's GlennFordBio.com. Of course, Glenn is with two N's, but GlennFordBio.com and all the information's there and lots of photos and links and things. So
now I'm struck by, in our library alone, and certainly your dad spent a great deal of time at Columbia Pictures, which is not our library, but he spent, I would say, the greater part of 10 or 15 years at MGM, which is part of our library, and we have 26 of his films in our vault. Day of the Evil Gun, which was made in 1967. I understand that you were in that film as well.
Yes, I was, and we shot that down in Durango, Mexico. Jerry Thorpe was the director, and I had a role in that. Jerry had penciled me in for a much bigger role, but I was at USC then and studying for my BA, which I did end up getting in 68, but I had to go back to school because my classes were calling to me, and I was so distraught but anyway I played, and you'll see a scene in there when my father comes across a band of rebels, Civil War guys, and that was us. We were kind of Harry Dean Stanton was our leader, so you know you can take it from there. And but I had fun in that because I was on the set every day during that shooting. I shot a famous wonderful stuntman for some of the people out there who are long in the tooth and know about this stuff. A guy named Davy Sharp, and Davy Sharp was an Indian, and I shot Davy out of a church steeple, and then in turn Davy shot me with an arrow. So I have a nice shot of me in color laying on the floor of wherever I was on that set with a big arrow in my back. But it's fun. I did a lot of films with Dad, and some parts were negligible, others were better. But there was an incident on that film, as you know by reading my book, George. If I might just take another minute, because this might be important for your listeners to know, I you know, growing up as a movie star's son is not necessarily all pleasurable, and I respect my dad greatly as an actor, but we didn't have the greatest father-son relationship. But at any rate, I come from a long line of wounded offspring, and on that film, one of the people who never appeared on camera was Lon Chaney Jr. And I was kind of the dialogue director on that show as well. And I was asked to work with Lon on getting ready for his part. And he came down and he was in terrible shape. He was a drinker. I went and we were staying at this place in Durango. It was a desolate, godforsaken place called the Campo de Mexico Courts, at this motel kind of place. And we had tarantulas all over the place and lizards. It was just grim. But anyway, so I was working with Lon, and of course we all know him as, you know, Mice and Men and all of his, the Wolfman, these great, great parts, and he could not remember his lines, and he was drinking, and there was an incident one night just before they sent him home where he fell into my arms crying about the fact that he had a horrible relationship with his dad, and how, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and, you know, it's driven him down. And here I am holding Lon Chaney, you know, the Wolf Man, in my arms, and he's crying, and I'm thinking to myself, George, well, wait a minute, it hasn't been so good for me either. So here are these two offspring. One is completely gone, and here I am, you know, feeling kind of sorry for myself, too. It's kind of, you'd have to have been there, I guess, but it was an interesting kind of a thing. But they sent him back. And he just couldn't cut it, and I think he had a few parts after that, but then he passed. But I'll never forget Lon Chaney Jr. And that experience we had in that horrible hotel down there in Durango, Mexico, one night.
I think that the importance of that isn't lost on anyone, because the relationship you would have, as he had, as so many people that I know whose parents were very famous, it does create a situation that only those of you in that situation can really understand what that's like. And we who are not, I think, find it fascinating. And I think for me, a lot of the people I know who have very, very famous parents, they have parent-children relationships just as people who aren't famous do. There is that whole extra layer of fame adds a complication. And of course, for our listeners who don't know, and we're going to talk about this with you at another time because it's going to warrant at least another full podcast, but your mom was also a silver screen legend of the highest order, the wonderful Eleanor Powell.
Yes, thank you.
So we have many of her films in the Warner Archive Collection, and we're going to have to talk to you about her another time. How many of your dad's films did you work on? Do you know?
I think about eight, and mm-hmm. I was a dialogue coach on many of them. And then, of course, we did Cage County together, which you wouldn't have in your archives. That was.
But I remember watching that.
Yeah,
love that show.
Yeah, I was the ballistics deputy, and I had most of my scenes with Edgar Buchanan, the great scene stealer. You know, I tell you, George, I laugh because I'd have a couple of pages of dialogue, and Edward would come in, and he did the whole series in his bedroom slippers, by the way. They never shot him above the knees, you know. But he's such a scene stealer. I would come home and I sweat through my dialogue, and I'd go there and I'd do my scene, and I'm looking at Edgar the whole time. He's scratching his ear, he's making little faces, you know, and I'm not looking at me, and I'm thinking, you know, that's horrible. I mean, so, but he was a consummate scene stealer, and as was my dad, actually, but a great guy. But yeah, we had a lot of fun on that. But I did eight films, but I got, you know, working even small roles. I got to work with Joan Blondell and Betty Davis. I had a small role in Pocketful of Miracles, of Frank Capra's last film.
I love that movie, even if it isn't ours.
All of those great, great, you know, I sat in Mary Pickford's knee when I was little, and I knew Marion Davies quite well at the end of her life. So, you know, you name it, I'm back there with all of those people of the films of the Golden Age.
And as I read your book, that you had amazing stories to relate, very poignant and heartfelt. And I, again, urge everyone listening to go to your website, glennfordbio.com, correct?
Yes, sir.
With
thank
two
you.
N's.
Yeah.
Your dad really got his start in the movies at Columbia, is that correct?
Well, actually, his first break, he came to California from Canada. He's Canadian, and he came from Quebec in 1922 when he was seven. And they came for the sunshine, the orange trees, the seagulls, the ocean, and all of those things that I guess people would leave a chilly Canada for. And he struggled, trying to get a break in the film. He wanted to be an actor from the get-go. And his first time on film, which he has in his diary, which I told you I have, he said, I'll never have a career in film. I was terrible. But he did this little thing called A Night in Manhattan at Paramount. It was a little short he did in 1937, actually on Easter Sunday. And so that was his first experience. And just for the Uber fans out there, I have a copy of that, by the way, George. I should burn a disc for you and show it to you. But he is wearing a tuxedo. They told him he has to come in a tux, but he had no money. His family were quite poor. His dad, my grandfather, and he used to go fishing for fish off the pier in Santa Monica, and they would scrape the mussels off the pier. He'd wade in with a knife and scrape mussels off, and that was really a feast for them. So at any rate, did not have the money for the tuxedo, so they got into the wardrobe department at Paramount, and they found a tuxedo, and my dad was able to squeeze into it, and that's what he was wearing. And for all of those Uber fans out there, if you ever see Marlene Dietrich in Morocco, that is the tuxedo that my father's wearing in Night in Manhattan.
That's a famous tuxedo.
Yeah, the famous tuxedo, and that was his debut. But he actually went to Fox. And he was cast, and it's a long story, but it's in the book, in this kind of forgettable film called Heaven with a Barbed Wire Fence with Gene Rogers. But then he got picked up by Columbia, as you say, and he was just a contract player, nothing happening, but he got signed in 1940 for his first 7 years at Columbia by Harry Cohen. And he did that film, of course, as we all know. Gilda was his with Rita Hayworth was his breakout film, which kind of made him a star.
The earliest film of his that I've seen, and I saw it because it co-stars someone who I believe was a good friend to your dad, and I know was a good friend and idolized your mom, and that was Ann Miller, who starred with him in Go West, Young Lady.
Yes.
And Annie was almost like family to me. We were very, very close.
Oh, me too.
And she pointed out in that film how she literally beat up Penny Singleton, because she was the bad bar girl and Penny Singleton was the good girl. When people see that movie, which it's on television frequently now, it used to be very hard to see, it's quite hysterical. But your dad was already a leading man in his first year at Columbia.
Yeah, no, he was. He came right out of the box. It was Bees in those days, the Bee pictures, of course. It was Convicted Woman, Babies for Sale with Rochelle Hudson and those kind of films. And we certainly don't have time for this. Plus, it's Warner Brothers, so we don't want to talk about it. But how he got Gilda is very interesting in what happened. But excuse me, it was actually Warner Brothers that really got him Gilda.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because I think we're going to go in the same direction. The very first Glenn Ford classic in our Warner Archive Collection Library is A Stolen Life
with
Miss Betty Davis.
Yes.
So was your dad loaned to Warner Brothers?
Yes, well, that's
Columbia?
What I was going to say. I just mentioned I didn't want to talk about Gilda because we're talking about Warner Brothers and MGM, your catalog. But what happened was that. Well, gosh, this is a long story, George, and I don't know.
We have all the time. Please,
really?
We're anxious to hear.
All right. Well, my dad came home from the war. He was a Marine, and and Harry had nothing for him at Columbia, and he was just desolate. He and Bill Holden were buddies. They had made Texas together in 1941 at Columbia, and Bill came home and Dad came home, and there was just nothing. And they felt that my dad, even in his diaries, was saying, maybe I need to go over to the Douglas Aircraft Factory and get a job, because Harry wasn't—he was under contract, but he wasn't making enough money. So he was thinking of getting a job, with his buddies over making airplane parts after the war. And so anyway, he went to the commissary at Warner Brothers to have lunch with a writer friend of his by the name of Jerry Asher, and he's sitting there just having lunch, and they're just visiting. Jerry was he wrote for movie magazines and other things. And Betty Davis, who was, one of your great stars.
The first lady of Warner Brothers, yes.
From across the room and beckoned him over and basically said to, she said to her retinue there, who is that over there? And oh, that's a contract player at Columbia, and bring him over here. So he was summoned, and she said to him, do you smoke a pipe? And he said, he didn't, but he said, yes. And do you have a tweed jacket with leather, you know, on the elbows, you know, one of those smoking jackets or tweedy Englishy jackets? He said yes, which he didn't have. But at any rate, she said, well, I want you to test for the lead in my film, which, of course, as you know, is A Stolen Life. And I guess Robert Alda was under contract. They had all kinds of other people in mind because Jack Warner didn't want to hire somebody from the outside, because why do that when he's already paying people there? But I guess this was, she was producing this herself. She insisted on my father, and that was the break he got. Well, Harry Cohen, of course, thinks to himself, my God, who is Glenn Ford, first of all? I know he's one of my people, but, you know, he hasn't worked for me for 3 years. He decides that he's going to capitalize on Warner Brothers' publicity because they had all the money, and as we know, Harry was a cheap Charlie, you know.
Yes.
So they rushed together and put together this film, Gilda. And had it written, and they went into production. In fact, during the filming, Virginia Van Upp, the writer, was sending pages down in the morning. They didn't even know what they were going to shoot that day. And my dad was always a quick study. But at any rate, they threw together this film, Gilda. And even though Dad had made A Stolen Life with Betty first, Harry released Gilda before A Stolen Life. He got it cut and out. So that when all of this hoopla came out about from Jack Warner with his payroll, you know, doing all of this publicity, here's Harry with Gilda on the market. So, he was pretty shrewd, old Harry Cohen, but he capitalized on Jack's money and between A Stolen Life with Warner's and with that, all of the smoldering sex stuff with the Rita, that's all it took. My dad took off.
A Stolen Life happens to be one of our best-selling titles and one of our most popular films.
Really? Oh, great.
Yeah. I did not know that Gilda came. I knew it was made around the same time, but I didn't know that the order of things, and that's quite fascinating.
Yeah, it was produced after A Stolen Life. My dad finished A Stolen Life, and Harry got him into doing Gilda, and then he released it before Stolen Life. So, you know, Harry was a character. He was a character, that's for sure.
One of the things about your dad's career that's so evident to me, it reminds me in a way from a directorial point of view of a director that your dad worked with, Vincent Minnelli, whom they did The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse
right.
together. The thing about Vincent's career that astounds me is he could master every genre. And your dad is one of those actors who was equally brilliant in drama, comedy, westerns. It seemed that he could do it all. I don't think he ever made a musical. You can correct me about that.
No, I don't think, unless that Go West, Young Lady could be considered a musical, but not really in the truest sense. But no, you're right. He was amazing, and you never caught him acting. He was a fine actor, a great actor, really, and there's a handful of them, but I think my father probably has been known as the most underrated great actor around, and he never was never nominated. Never got. He did get a Golden Globe, but you know, and all of the reviews from those later years at MGM that I have, and when he did Trial and Ransom and all those other films, Blackboard Jungle, everybody said, "Oh, not only will he be nominated, he's going to win." He never got nominated, so I don't know. He's kind of the forgotten man, George. But
well, I think your book has gone a long way to change that, and we've tried in our way with making more of his films available. This is, as I said, Day of the Evil Gun is the 12th within the Warner Archive collection that we've been able to bring to DVD. And then other classics like The Blackboard Jungle and Tea House of the August Moon were already available, Cimarron. And yet we have so many more to go. One of the films that we're in the midst of remastering and plan to release soon is a charming film, which I also believe you were in, 1964's Dear Heart. I think that's another off-the-beaten-path film that isn't quite the expected film and it takes people by surprise because it's grown up
adult. Yeah, very much in that 64 genre of film, you know, starring the great Geraldine Page. I mean, my father said there of the actresses he worked with, there were three actually four, who he thought were, he would never say this publicly, but you know, that he adored as working with because they were so professional, and Geraldine was certainly one of them. She and yeah, I played the part of Shorty in that film, and I'm 6'2", but they Dale Mann, the director, wanted me taller because, you know, for the obvious reason, I was Shorty, so I had to be 6'8". They put me in elevator shoes, and I was walking around in the lobby paging Miss Evie Jackson. That, you know, she had herself paged to make herself you know, bigger than life. But she was a sweetheart, and that was just a great that was a great experience too. So
well, we're hoping to be bringing that out at some point at the toward the end of the year once we finish putting the proper version together, because they apparently changed it during previews, and it was originally supposed to be called The Out of Towners.
Yes.
So it's been a big project of ours.
But let me just say this for my family, and I'm an only child. Bless you for all of that you're doing, because Turner Classic Movies and you and. You know, I mean, if it weren't for you guys, nobody would, you know, would know who any of these people, much less my dad. But you know, all these great, great work. Because it's, I'm afraid our young people today need to be refreshed in the history of film, because film is so, so very important, and has been, and will always be to our culture. But bless you guys.
Well, I thank you for your kind words, and that's our mission, is to get the films out there, because they, especially the films that are timeless. The Gazebo is one of our best-selling films, which your dad did with Debbie Reynolds. Two films they did together. It started with A Kiss and The Gazebo, almost back-to-back.
And The Gazebo was the first part I had that I spoke in the beginning of that one, George. Now that you know, you have to go look at it again, but in the very beginning, he comes out of his control room. I was 14, and he comes out of the control room, and my first line, I think I got paid $70, but it cost me over $100 to join SAG, but at any rate... I said, "Great show, Mr. Nash," and that's, you know, he just nodded. But there's a bellboy there, or a, you know, a page, studio page, saying, "Great show, Mr. Nash," at age 14, and that was me. So, but those were great times, and of course, George Marshall, what a guy. I mean, what a great director and a great guy. He directed that, and I just love George, and, you know, so many great memories.
Known for his comic timing and his training at the Hal Roach Studios working on Laurel and Hardy shorts.
He was doing Silence, I think, in 1916.
Yes.
It's amazing, you know, and to my dad's credit, when we did Cates County together, he called back a lot of his old buddies from the old days, and George came on set and directed a couple of Cates County. So he... You know, he had the power to, you know, I mean, not that David Gerber and those people at Fox wouldn't have had some directors, but, you know, he made sure he took care of his old buddies from the old days, you know, Leo Penn and Alf Schelling and George Marshall and some of those guys, you know, who might not have might have been working and needed a paycheck. So to my dad's credit, he, and of course with old Edgar Buchanan, I think they made like 13 films together. So he took care of his friends. That was commendable.
Now, your dad was at MGM for, I think, almost 15 years. Is that accurate?
Yes. He left Columbia, his last film at Columbia. He left that, which I think was The Violent Men, and which is a good film. But he went immediately over, and Dory Sherry had taken over at the MGM. You know, Louis B. Mayer passed, and sometime before, and Dory was there, and they had taken a whole new... You know, I mean, films like Blackboard Jungle and Ransom and Trial would never have been made if Louis were there. But Dory Sherry had a different vision. And, of course, times had changed, and we were getting into the film. I don't need to give you a history lesson, George, but, you know, I mean, things were changing. And anyway, so Dad went over, and he did this kind of audition film, which I know is on your archives, called Interrupted Melody.
Absolutely.
With Eleanor Parker. And... that was kind of a, do you like us, do we like you, kind of a movie that he did. And I think he did a great job in that one, too. But it was truly Richard Brooks and Blackboard Jungle that changed my father's career completely. And he finished, in those days, he used to work a six-day week. And so he finished Interrupted Melody on a Saturday, and on Monday he started work on Blackboard Jungle with Dick Brooks. And that film, that weekend, on that Sunday, between the Saturday and the Monday start, Dick took Dad into the barbershop at MGM and gave him a buzz cut. And, it, you know, you look at him, it's amazing, you know, you look at his hair or you look at a scene still or anything, you know, from Interrupted Melody, and he looks just like Johnny Farrell from Gilda with his great hair, you know. And then you look at him the next day in Blackboard Jungle with this Marine buzz cut, which, of course, you know, Dick Brooks was a Marine, and he wanted him to be what he wanted him to be. And Dad, to his credit, let Dick have his way, and he said, okay, I'm going to trust you. And a lot of extemporation in their dialogue with these young students, of course, you know, Sidney Poitier, and I was very fortunate you guys invited me to come out and do the backstory on that film that you released, and I enjoyed that. I got Jamie Farr to come in, and Joel Freeman was the assistant director. He's still around. And, of course, I couldn't get Sidney to come in, but Sidney Poitier and some of those great guys, Vic Morrow. But at any rate, he really changed, and he became kind of a different actor. It's quite amazing. And boy, I tell you, then is when, as I mentioned earlier, that everybody said, oh, he's on his way. You know, he's going to get this and that because, you know, he was fine, but Harry put him in a lot of what I call tripe, you know, not the greatest films. But at MGM, he really flourished. And he was one of the last contract, players there. I think Bob Taylor was still there and some others. But he ended up getting Clark Gable's dressing room. And, you know, of course, things were different then than they were when my mom was a big star at MGM. But still in all, he had quite a career there. And it really is, other than a few loan outs, his whole career was based on at Columbia and at MGM.
What was the first film of his that you recall being on the set, you know, as a child? Do you remember?
The first film that I remember being on a set was not one of his, but it was Lady of Shanghai with Rita when Orson had her as a blonde. And I have got a great picture of me being cuddled between Rita Hayworth and Glenn Ford, visiting the lady and the lady from Shanghai.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. I'll just show you that one day. But the first film that I really, let me think. I mean, I certainly remember going to visit him on Blackboard Jungle because I would go, of course, then, you know, he's the big star on the lot, so I, as the little prince, you know, I could wander all over the place. And I remember going over to the Forbidden Planet set and visiting, of course, Anne, you know.
and Robbie the Robot.
You know, oh, my God, and Robbie the Robot, and of course, Dad knew and had worked with a few times Earl Holliman, and I knew Walter Pidgeon and all those people, so I was like, you know, just wonderful. But I don't know, I can't really think of when, but the first one that I really recall being very, very active would be Blackboard Jungle.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to recall that you had some involvement with the music.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I'm remembering right.
Yes, you are. Dick Brooks, Richard Brooks, the director, was looking for some, you know, current music to counterpoint Dick Spiderbeck and Stan Kenton and all of the stuff that was being used in there. And he came to our house, and I was like this little savant of rock and roll. Actually, it wasn't rock and roll then. It was rhythm and blues or what they call race music in those days. And I loved all of that stuff. And anyway, Dick took a couple of my records to MGM and played them for Joel Freeman, who remembers very fondly. And one of them was A Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and the Comets, and I guess MGM bought the rights and put it in the film. So when we went to the premiere out at the Encino Theater, it was just before my 10th birthday, and we went out there with Dad's agent and Mr. Brooks and Pandro Berman and the producer and others. And boy, I tell you, when that movie opened up on the big screen and my record, you know, 1-2 in Lockport, I thought I died and gone to heaven, because I'd never, you know, I mean, I heard it in my record player, but to hear it on the big screen. And so anyway, that's my...
So you were a music supervisor before such things existed.
Yeah. Dick Clark has called that the national anthem of rock and roll. So that's my footnote to rock and roll history.
Well,
so what can I tell
you? Another film of your dad's I want to ask you about, because it was a reunion with Rita Hayworth and it was at MGM, is The Money Trap.
Yes, yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well,
were you on the set
for
that?
Rita at the end of her career there, it was, you know, it was not, it wasn't really good. I don't know. Some call that the last film noir. I don't know if
right.
correct, that, but that's what it's known
that's
as.
A lot of people really love it, and the people at the Film Noir Foundation are actually showing it in their upcoming Film Noir Festival this year.
Yeah, I was supposed to be in that too, but I didn't make the cut. And in fact, I think one of Bob Mitchum's sons played the role of parking lot attendant. I was supposed to do that, but I couldn't do it. I don't know. I had a conflict. But at any rate, I knew Dear Rita from early on. I mean, from
the lady from Shanghai picture.
She was at my wedding when I married Linda, and I knew her. She lived next door to. My dad passed, and I inherited his house, and she lived next door to Dad in those days. And every time I'd come over to visit my father, she was here by the pool talking with him, and she was just a dear, dear friend. But The Money Trap, that was they made, I think, 5 films together.
Yeah.
Of course, Loves of Carmen, the one that they did in Lone Pine in 1948 for Columbia, was... he always said that was the worst film ever made, and he would do anything to burn every negative if he could ever get his hands on it.
I can't say I disagree with that. The Money Trap, I thought, was a wonderful thing to see them on screen together 20 years after Gilda.
Yes, yep. And Bert Kennedy, I think, directed that.
Yes. We have a Facebook page where consumers constantly let us know what they'd like to see us release, and we get so many inquiries and questions about Glenn Ford and Glenn Ford films. His popularity seems to be so enduring. I know you deal with this in the book, but can you, like, for our audience that's listening, succinctly kind of think, express why you think his popularity resonates so much with such strength with the people who watched his films for years?
Oh, yes, and I get a tremendous amount of emails from people saying the same thing. I tell you, I think it's because he was such a consummate actor. And as I said earlier, I mean, his background came from the stage. He was a stage actor, little theater in Santa Monica. He worked and worked and worked in theater. I have playbills from probably 100 plays he was in. So he honed his craft on stage, and he was just a great actor. And I think that he was believable. He never gave a bad role, and I think anything he did well. And I think when people see 2 or 3 or 4 of his films, they say, well, gee, you know, this guy, you know, who is this guy, if they don't know? And I just think as you said earlier, George, he did it all. He, you know, the noirs, the westerns, the Navy comedies, you know, Don't Go Near the Water, and and of course that movie he did with Brando, you know, TLC August Moon, which I personally believe he stole from Brando.
Oh, without question.
Yeah, I mean, it's supposed to be Brando's film, but...
it's Glenn Ford's movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was a lot of tension between Marlon and my dad on that film, and I get into that in the book, but there's reasons why I do. But at any rate, I just think he was a fine actor, and I think people who appreciate good acting, they gravitate to talent, and he was certainly one of the best.
The roles were so varied. The films that we have, films like Fastest Gun Alive, The Sheep Man, those are the Western side,
right.
Just like we're releasing Day of the Evil Gun now. But then there's pictures like The Rounders, where he and Henry Fonda, the screen chemistry is just amazing.
Yeah, and he loved that movie, by the way, and he liked Hank very much and Henry Fonda very much. And that's a small little film that really never, you know, not to pick on... Well, I guess I can pick on MGM now because they're gone, but they
That's
didn't
right.
publicize that well enough. I mean, it was kind of, they just dismissed it. It came out as the second bill on Get Yourself a College Girl. I mean, can you believe that, George?
Absolutely.
That's how they released that. And it's a shame because it's a sweet little film.
It's one of our most popular sellers since we've put it out. Somebody just wrote last week, when are you going to release The Rounders? And I sent, an email back to the consumer saying, here's where you can get it. And he's like, I love this movie. I love Glenn Ford and Henry Fonda.
Oh, yeah.
Wish they had made more movies together.
Well, Chill Wills and, of course, Edgar, you know, Buchanan. And don't forget, Peter Fonda and I had a small role on that too, George.
That's right.
On that street scene when they put their hats over the naked bottoms of... of the two girls there, Holiday and Sue Ann Langdon. We're in that street scene. We were extras, but you're not going to see that credit on Peter Fonda's.
Now, a lot of people know your dad that don't know his earlier work as Jonathan Kent in Superman.
Oh, yeah.
I think that role, before John Schneider played it on Smallville, you know, your dad being Jonathan Kent resonates with a whole new generation of moviegoers that may not know about his earlier films. Was he really excited to play that part because it was small but very meaningful?
Yes, he was, and he did that up in Toronto, Canada. And again, it's a very small part, but I think when, you know, today young people at least, or younger people, they think of Superman as the Glenn Ford film, even though he had just a small role. But he did that so well that Richard Donner,
yes,
the director, they thought he was actually having a heart attack. And Donner said to Dad, "You want to rehearse?" And, you know, how do you see this role? And da-da-da-da. My dad, no, he said, "I'm fine. I know exactly what I'm going to do." And it was a one-shot, one-take deal. And he did it, I think, just flawlessly and expertly. So it was interesting because when I was a young actor, before I realized I couldn't make a living acting and I became a building contractor, I did a Mr. Novak. Remember that series?
Yes, that's all. We own that series. We hope to bring it out someday.
Yeah, James Franciscus, rather. And I played Frankie Avalon's buddy in a car club. And guess who the director was? It was Richard.
Dick Donner.
Donner. And so I was so excited because I had this pretty good part in that Mr. Novak one, that I invited Dad to come down and have lunch with me on my set, you know. So he came down, we were on location, he came down and I introduced him to Dick, to Dick Donner. And
then 12 or 13 years later.
That's how they met. And I'm sure that they saw each other subsequently, but the first time he met Richard Donner was on the Mr. Novak set.
That's
having
wonderful.
Lunch with his son. But Dick Donner said that Dad was just did an incredible job, and he was so convincing that the whole crew thought he actually had a heart attack. But yeah, it was a nice role in a very, very important film.
I'm just going to mention the films in the Warner Archive Collection starring Glenn Ford that are available now and let you and the audience know: A Stolen Life from 1946, Interrupted Melody, 1955, The Fastest Gun Alive, 1956, The Wonderful Don't Go Near the Water, 1957, The Sheep Man with Shirley MacLaine, 1958, It Started with a Kiss and the Gazebo, co-starring Debbie Reynolds, 1959, Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, 1962, Advance to the Rear with Stella Stevens, 1964, Dear Heart Will Be Coming Soon, The Money Trap now available, The Rounders now available, and the brand new release of Day of the Evil Gun, and much more to come, Imitation General, Trial, Ransom, all of those are in the future. So we intend to honor the cinematic legacy of your dad, and we really also look forward to talk to you about the Queen of Tap, your amazing mom, Ms. Eleanor Powell.
Thank you very much, George.
So, Peter Ford, thank you so much for joining us today for this Warner Archive Collection podcast. And everybody out there, thanks for listening. Please follow us on Twitter and look for our Facebook page, facebook.com/Warner Archive. And also, we want to acknowledge Glenn Ford Alive, now available at the glennfordbio.com website, Peter Ford's wonderful book about his dad. Peter, thanks so much for talking to us today. We look forward to the next time we can get together and talk.
Great. I have lots of good stories about Eleanor Powell for you.
We're looking forward to it. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.